Hi everyone, welcome at RaveAct. Today with a super special guest, Mark Paul from Ethereum. He's the founder of that blockchain protocol. And we basically talked about data ownership, which is the core pain point his platform or protocol tries to solve. And it was just an exciting and really authentic discussion. So if you have, I think it was an hour, then really tune in. There's a lot to learn. I learned a lot myself. I'm a blockchain engineer, so it's a really enjoyable episode. Thanks for watching.
WaveAct, the web-free software company that understands what you want.
Hi, Mark. Thank you for being here. It's really a pleasure talking with you. When I did my research, something that really caught my attention was basically, you have it in your LinkedIn bio as well, that you pride yourself with being 20 years already, which is a really long time in that industry. 20 years of experience within software development and delivery. So as a software developer myself, I would really love to know what were some of your key learnings, key challenges that you over those 20 years actually have learned or faced yourself.
Yeah, so firstly, thanks for having me, Kevin. Super excited about this opportunity. Most people in crypto just will literally start their journey into crypto, whereas for me, it was very different. I spent two decades in traditional Web2 companies. Started off as a software engineer, was a software architect, ended up as in engineering leadership. So I went through the whole rank of the different roles a software engineer could go through. So my journey began that way and then ended up in Web3 or blockchain or crypto when I really saw that, you know, a lot of the problems we're trying to solve in the Web2 world, you needed a different approach. So I think that's my shift to Web3. So I guess the learnings in terms of software engineering is that basically, regardless of whether you're a Web2 software engineer working with different clouds or whether you're a Web3 software engineer working with different blockchains, it's still the underlying principles of software engineering. You still have to be a good engineer to build these things, regardless of where you're building them. So I think the learnings are always the fundamentals. Like, you understand the fundamentals of what you're trying to do. When you're working in Web3, you're still working with products, so you could understand product engineering. How do you design a product? How do you engage with users? How do you build user experiences of good UX and UI? It's basically the same thing, which I found. What I love about Web3, of course, is the opportunity to try technology that is in its inception. And that is quite rare, because as software engineers, usually we are told, hey, here's the tech stack, build. In Web3, you're saying, here's the tech stack. The tech stack is still under development. And, you know, so that's quite exciting for me. These are some of the key learnings that I've had.
So it's more about the opportunity, the personal excitement about the space that actually ultimately drove you into that.
So I think for me personally, like in Web2, I was involved in the data side of things for many years. So I was involved in, I used to work for the government here in Australia, and I was in the data department. So I could see these huge issues with data and individuals and citizens in our country, how their data is locked up in these different silos. I wanted to somehow try to solve this, and I knew you could never do this with traditional Web2 technology, because it's centralized. You needed a different way to think of it. So for me, it was, how do I take a problem that was huge in the Web2 world and apply a different frame of thinking to try and solve it? So it's at the end of the day, it's problem solving, right? You're a software engineer and you love to problem solve. This is like fundamentally kind of what drives me as well. I want to solve the problem by any means necessary.
So basically, you thought about the huge amount of data that, you know, these large corporates actually do own or have about the users, about the employers, about their business intelligence. And what was the pain point that you saw there, just so that it's a little bit more tangible?
Yeah. So a few pain points. The first is it became obvious that if you look at all the apps and services that we use and we think that are free, in reality are not free. It's this moment that hits you like, hold on, how can it be free? And then you realize that actually I'm paying for it with my data. So that's the first realization when you realize, okay, if this company is giving me a free service, they must really value my data. So that's the first light bulb that goes off. My data is valuable. So I think, and the second one is you realize that even if I'm okay by giving away my data to centralized companies, they lock it up in a data silo, right? So they lock it up in their silo. So my data never reaches its benefit. For example, if I take my health data and I join a health app and I push all my data into this health app, I would love it if this data is shared with maybe a wider group of health companies that could potentially proactively look at my data and tell me if there's something wrong with me. Why should it be that only that one company hold on to my data and then try to tell me what's wrong with it? It should be open. So there's two things. You know, the first one is when I realize the data is valuable, my data is valuable. Second is that we have to break the silos that you have in Web2, like where they hold the data because it took them so much effort to getting it, to taking it from you, right? So they hold it and it never reaches its full potential. So these are the key drivers as to why we are trying to solve this problem.
Mm-hmm. Your protocol, is that correct? Like,
that's correct.
From my understanding, right?
Yeah.
You basically try to give the power back to the user, right? You own it, you can monetize it, and all these things that everyone basically wants to do with their own information, right? How does that actually map into that pain point? Because I could imagine if the user actually has true ownership, depending on the kind of user that you have in front of you, that it actually might even increase some silos in some way. Could that be? Because I maybe only want to share it with healthcare companies, which of course is already an advantage that you give, right? You have that industry kind of sharing that you could provide or something like that, instead of that company-wide silo. But at the same time, you maybe create some other silos. Or what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah. So let's use examples, right? So let's imagine... Let's use a fun example. So let's say you use Spotify and it's you're listening to music. So you're paying for the service. Spotify is a great app. Performance is great. And, you know, you've created all of these playlists in Spotify of music that you like. Now, in a way, this is your data because you have actually fed the algorithm with some of your preferences, right? Wouldn't it be great if you could somehow claim ownership of this curation service that you provided? So you curated your playlist. This is your data. And you could share this. So you take ownership of that. And that's a data asset that now belongs to you. And you decide what you want to do with it. You can decide, okay, I'm going to share it with some other music service. So basically, I've made my data portable. So, you know, your preferences are now being moved to another service and another service and another service. So you're no longer locked into Spotify in that example. Or maybe what you want to do is say, you know what, this is my music, personalized music, what I love. I want to now correlate that with maybe something else that I do. Like, you know, this is my profile information, my age group. Maybe this is another data set, which is, hey, I'm also a gamer and I'm playing all these games and I'm listening to this music when I'm playing for these games. So you'll start to notice that you are generating your personal data as like these different groups that you want to somehow take ownership of and then decide who you want to share that with. Now, you had a very valid point there. If we are very successful in what we do, what might happen is that we might end up converting this big corporation data silos into personal data silos, because then you might end up being a silo yourself because you're not sharing anymore. So the way we think this is going to get solved and the way we're working towards how this is going to get solved is step one is we make it seamless for you to take ownership of your real world data, in that example, Spotify, but it could be your gaming data, your anything. Step two is we want to make it seamless for you to share it or trade it if you want to. So we have achieved that too with our data NFT technology. And step three is maybe I want to just delegate this to another entity who's like a DAO or a transparent entity. And that DAO collects a bunch of similar data sets and then let it decide what it wants to do with it. So maybe that DAO is just purely dedicated to trading it in bulk or finding a use case for it. But the benefit here is that I can exit from this at any given time. If I no longer want to be part of this bulk data DAO, we call it data coalition DAOs, by the way, you can exit from it at any given time. So what you here realize is that fundamentally, we are letting you take ownership of your data and then deciding what you want to do with it. This already exists, by the way. This happens in the world we live in right now. It's just that you have no idea it's happening. You are just a pawn in this game. And there's this entity called data brokers, effectively, they broker the trade of your data. So they buy it from different entities, they sell it on to different entities. So this whole data market happening that none of us know anything about. So what we're trying to do is, you know, build a sort of decentralized data brokerage infrastructure where people can plug in and out, enterprises can plug in and out, or even app developers can plug in and out. So we are infrastructure layer. So we are building the sort of the tools for data ownership and data tokenization, data governance, and then you can literally build apps on top of it. Our ideal scenario is in that example I spoke about where they say Spotify. We would like a decentralized Spotify built on top of Ethereum that provides you the same user experience, but now you are a participant in this sort of data economy as well.
You said a couple of very interesting things, and something that I could imagine, I'm pretty interested now in your from your perspective, when you remove that lock-in effect from platforms, right, which you effectively do if you make that data sharing seamless and it's easy for users to switch without any inconvenience from that regard, from a data perspective, that's actually what you don't want to have as a Web2 platform, at least, right? Web3 people actually might have a different target group and then will market themselves as being, as not having a lock-in effect or something like that. But just from what you have seen over the last years, how difficult actually is it to find partners in Web2? Just so that I can rough idea.
Yeah, absolutely. So we, you know, the idea of data ownership, we as Ethereum as an idea has existed for 5 years right now. About it's purely the same idea around data sovereignty. As a Web3 protocol, has existed for about 3 years. So when we began this journey, that was 2020. It was all hype, right? People were just into crypto and blockchain because all hype stuff. But we've kind of evolved, right? We initially started with telling an individual, hey, your data is worth something, claim ownership of it. And now, you know, we're in a state where we realize, you know, that's not good enough, right? You can't just say, here, claim ownership of your data. What are you going to do with this? We could give you some token rewards, but that's not really what we are trying to do. We're actually trying to solve the problem. So this is why probably in the last quarter or last 2 quarters, we are kind of figuring out who's on the other side of this equation. It has to be an enterprise consumer of this data. So we actually spent a lot of time speaking to enterprises, and then we kind of realized it's very early. A lot of them don't want to get exposed to blockchain because of the negative impressions of crypto in general. But this sentiment is changing. If you look at the Web2 companies who are dabbling in Web3, they are dabbling in it for a different reason, and that is community. If you look at a lot of the big Web2 brands that are minting NFT collections, why are they doing this? It's to engage communities in new ways, right? And what we're seeing, and you're in Europe, I believe, so you probably see this a lot, where there's a lot of the sort of regulation around data sovereignty, right? With GDPR and stuff like this. What if an enterprise has some way to engage with their user community around the principles of data ownership? This is, in another way, engaging their brand users in a sort of aspect like that. So we are trying to introduce the concept of data ownership to individuals like you and me, so we can take ownership of our data. But on the other end of the spectrum, for enterprises, to get them more comfortable, we're trying to teach them or show them how this could be a way for them to build user loyalty, which is very important now when people jump between brands. Why don't you give them this value proposition where maybe if they are with your brand, they can like co-own their data, okay? So maybe not own all your data, but at least you can co-own your data with the brand. So this is quite interesting. Like one of the projects we are working on right now is a loyalty card that's usable in the Web2 world. So you can actually go into stores and use this card. But the history of your behavior of using that actually belongs to the user holding the card. So it's co-owned data. So it's an interesting way to look at things, right? It's the regular business model. But instead of you as an organization taking all the benefits of the data, why not share some of that? And maybe you can get a more engaged consumer base.
That's a very interesting perspective. Speaking of data ownership, right? Just from that single example now, mm-hmm. data once shared cannot be unshared, right? That's a very common issue with a lot of these business models. But I have seen on your documentation, and that excited me when I read that you have that streaming as a data stream, basically, right? So from my understanding, once you sell the NFT, basically the right to access that information, you just mm-hmm. cut the stream. Is that correct? Or how does it work?
Well, it depends on why you would. So if you want to, are you saying that if you want to exit the system, would you be able to? Yeah. So exactly. So at the moment in our platform, you can tokenize a static data asset or a dynamic data asset. And the dynamic data asset is basically what you explained. It's a data stream. So which means basically the file keeps changing. Now, we get this question all the time, right? Because ultimately, when you use our protocol, we are just an NFT platform. Like we have an NFT marketplace, and maybe, but our NFTs are data NFTs. So if you get the NFT, you get a stream of data behind it. That's how we differentiate. Now, if you want to exit at the moment, based on our protocol, you can exit by stopping the stream. So you can actually stop the stream. But actually, that's unfair when you think about it. Like, 'cause what happens if a few hundred people have procured this data NFT, and the value of the data NFT was actually the stream of data that was behind it, not the art, right? Like traditional NFTs, the value is the art and the author or the creator. Here, the value is the data and the creator of the data. So in the current version of the protocol, you can exit by stopping the stream. Mm-hmm. And the NFT continues to live, but you know, it's almost like it goes from a data NFT to an NFT. So it's like a regular NFT. It still has art and stuff, but you know, that's really not why they're procuring the data NFT. So this solves the how can I exit problem, but it's not good, right? Because we still want to provide, if somebody procured this, they should get some value from it. So what we're doing right now is a couple of things. We're looking at snapshotting. So in other words, there are periodic snapshots that are stored on chain or an on-chain mechanism. So even if the person exits, there is a immutable forever snapshot of the data that I own. So that, you know, but again, this is opt-in because you might not want to do this for all types of data. The second is a commitment from the creator that they won't exit for a certain amount of time. So the data creator would bond tokens for a certain period, which could be slashed if they exit. So if you're, in other words, what we're saying is if you're minting a data NFT, you need to really think about, is this what you really want to do? Can I commit to it for at least 3 months? And if I do that, I bond the tokens, I mint it. After 3 months, I unbond and I exit. But at least you provide a service for a certain amount of time. That's how we kind of deal with this.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Quick intermission. If I could ask you for one single favor, it would be that you hit subscribe onto this channel, because it helps our channel more than you can imagine. And, you know, the bigger the channel gets, the bigger the guests get. So thank you very much for watching, and let's continue with the episode. Mm-hmm. Makes sense. I could imagine that That's the case from my experience in for a lot of crypto companies. But do you have some kind of a legal framework around that? Because I could imagine, like, either you need a very strong incentive system, basically that you as a data provider or the corporate itself doesn't share the data some other way, or do you work with zero knowledge, or just so that, how is that actually, how can people trust the platform? Like, how does the incentivation system work?
Yeah, so hopefully people don't have to trust the platform. So hopefully it's a trustless platform. Like, but what I get your point. Like, the incentivization, okay, it should be in multiple levels. Okay, I'll try to explain this with an example. So we have a Dota NFT collection at the moment, which is by a musician, right? So he's minted about 5 songs in a single stream that's behind the Dota NFT. And if you hold the Dota NFT, you can listen to his entire album, which is really cool. And he keeps updating it. Every time he produces new music, he pushes it into the stream. Now, of course, what happens if somebody's listening to this, makes a copy of it, and then tries to, you know, game the system and sell it as his own Dota NFT? So firstly, the Dota NFT terms of use for each creator is on-chain against the token, so you can always look it up. So if I'm listening to this person's stream of music on the token, I have his terms of use, which would state clearly this is non-commercial, so I can't reuse it. So that's a way you can put your sort of terms of use on it. Again, we have a way for the creator to exit. So if they don't want to participate anymore, they can exit. That's there too. And the third problem, what I mentioned there is, you know, somebody listened to this music, didn't care about the terms of use, made a copy. And well, this problem exists with NFTs in general, right? Like if you look at any NFT collection out there, I could go Bored Ape, right? I could go to Bored Ape. I could look at it. Oh, this is a great image. I'll save it and I mint another collection. Obviously, this is not going to work because people are not looking just purely at the image. They're looking at the creator, because that's what they're buying. So it's the same with us. They are not just purely buying it because it's a music data NFT. They're buying it because they can actually see the creator, and that's why they're doing it. So the third thing is, it's the same sort of dynamic with regular NFTs. But, you know, we're constantly looking at this, right? So there are some new incentives that we would offer for curation of data NFTs. So which means there might be a party that's curating these data assets and curating the data streams, making sure it's up or down, curating the creators even, like maybe do they actually have reputation? Are they a spammer? And we'll have a DAO where you can report these things onto, and then again, those bonds could get slashed. Ultimately, Ethereum as a protocol is, we shouldn't even exist. Like the DAO is governing it and curating it. And the protocol's incentives are bringing in new creators, making them stay for long, or allowing them to exit, giving them an exit path as well.
Okay, exciting. What would you say are the most exciting business or use cases that you have seen on your protocol so far?
Yeah, absolutely. So it began with a first version, I guess, early last year was... active data sets. So what do I mean by that is you need to do, you're like a creator of some sort. You're a musician, you're a data analyst, you're like somebody who actively creates a data asset, right? And then our current platform allows you, if you're this active data creators, to tokenize your data and then, you know, as a data NFT, and then do with it whatever you can with an NFT. The real powerful use case, man, is when we move from active data collection to passive data collection, where you're not a musician, but you're a gamer and you play games for 10 hours a day. Well, maybe that's an exaggeration, but let's say you play a lot of games. That data is valuable, very, 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 very valuable. How can you claim ownership of that? And can you then share it with someone or trade it? That is the secret. So I think Ethereum's focus in, I guess, this year is how do we move our platform from being just purely active data collection mode to passive data collection mode. And how can we get enterprises involved in the passive data collection mode? As an example, a gaming company launches a data NFT collection and distributes it to its community, and the community member buys the collection, connects their gaming platforms to it, PlayStation, Xbox, Steam, whatever it is, checks in their behavioral data once a week, and then has shared ownership of their data with the gaming platform, right? So they can share it with somebody else. It's portable now. They can move it to different platforms. This really excites me because this suddenly increases the user base based on the popularity of existing platforms. Like PlayStation, as an example, has millions of active users. If we can tap into that user base, that is super exciting to me.
Absolutely. What would be your dream customer or user, or just so that people get an idea?
I'm super excited about gaming. I think Q1 and Q2 focus this year is around how do we create a gaming data platform where the data contributors are the gamers themselves. So we're not talking about like getting data analysts to source and harvest gaming data. We're talking about a gaming data platform that the gamers directly plug into, right? This is most exciting to me, man, because it's insane how big the gaming market is. And if you can provide a uniform set of data, let's say if you can provide gaming data from 1,000 PlayStation active users, because it's very uniform, right? It's the same, it's very useful data. And you build on top of this a layer, a data insights layer. And that can be a Web2 data insights layer. You can literally build like a Web2 SaaS platform on top of this thing. What's so cool about this is it'll be the first platform where the data is sourced directly from the creator, right? That excites me. And that's gaming, but you know, you can take the same model and you can apply it to any industry. Health and wellness, you can apply it to finance, you can apply it to anything. Because ultimately, the way we look at it is, as an individual, we are emitting like petabytes worth of data. Can we like create, you know, like these buckets or streams of data which go into this pool, and then, you know, it kind of generates this really cool sort of data from origin sort of concept, which is really unique.
Okay. Yeah, well, big vision. I would say I'm curious about that one. How do you deal with the toxicity of the gaming community towards crypto? Because I've tried it myself, working with influencers there. It's really tough, man.
Did you say the toxic?
Yeah. Like, oh, really? If you say you're from crypto blockchain, at least last year they still were so. Maybe I'm in the wrong communities, right? But did you experience?
Yeah. So, 3 years ago when we launched, about two years ago, gaming and gaming guilds were like, you know, play to earn. That was like the hottest narrative, and I can kind of feel that pissed off a lot of Web2 people, because the games, let's be honest, were not that great, and there was all of this hype and nothing really came out of it. So I can imagine the Web2 sort of gaming people going like, oh, what the heck was that? But I hopefully, if we we're working on this product right now, by the way, we call it the Gamer Passport. Hopefully when we launch it, no one even knows there's a blockchain there, right? So it's just a platform for you to take ownership of your gaming data. No one knows there's an NFT at the bottom of it. There's some token at, like, that would be the ideal scenario. Like, you're using it because you love it, love this ability to open up an app and check in your gaming data every week, and then someone's using it and you can see who's using it. That would be the success. That's how I would define success, is we are able to put out a very popular app and no one cares that it's a blockchain based app.
How actually should be, right? Because blockchain is a tool, not
exactly solution. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, cool stuff. Just looking at your entrepreneurial journey itself, like, what would you say were your biggest aha or shocks that you experienced over the last 20 years? Like,
yeah, I mean, I think everyone, the biggest, it's not so much shocks, but some sort of realizations is that, you know, everyone has ideas, right? Like we always get ideas all the time. But I think the distance between the idea and the actual success is a huge distance. I think a lot of people don't realize that. So I've also realized that the hard way. Like you think you have a brilliant idea and you're like almost certain this is it. But then the distance between you even seeing any traction and that point of when you got that idea is so huge that most people, I feel, drop off, right? That's where there might be a lot of people who are going to do really well if they're just persistent. So I think that's the thing there that I would probably point as something I learned the hard way. And, you know, it's not even there yet, right? Like it's just another, it's continuing on, right? The journey. Yeah, and I think the other realization I've had is that you've got to move fast, like you've got to iterate fast and you've got to move fast. But ultimately, you know, the value of what you're building shouldn't be how much funds you've raised or the partners that you are demonstrating. It should be users, like how many users like your product. That should be the only metric. So this is another realization that it's very close to me right now. I'm like, I just want people to like what we're doing because it's a great platform. Not because of anything else, not for because it sounds cool or the white paper is great or it's, I love this product because I'm using it and it's great. So these are a couple of things I think that really kind of stay close to me right now.
Love it. Basically build an actual business, right? Not just raise money.
Yeah. Just... I mean, build like everyone gets caught up. Like I got the idea. I got to raise funds. Okay, cool. You have to do it. I understand that. But, you know, is it really something people want, you know? And like the way you judge that is people enjoy using it. And the way you get to that is you iterate quick because maybe it is a great idea. You just haven't reached the point of user experience. AI is a great example, man. Like it's been around for decades. It only reached the point of good user experience last year. It's like this long journey. But now it's like, oh, okay, wow, I get it because I can use it and I enjoy using it.
Yeah, it's like... If you look at all the big guys out there, right, what I've noticed is most of them focus on building actual great, sick products or having a super and super strong brand. Because if you have those two, you don't even need to focus on other parts of the business like sales, marketing, user acquisition. They will do the marketing for you. If you have a great product, actually solve a pain point, you have a business that works, you're fine, usually, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's very true. That goes back to the point of, you know, having users that love your product, that's, you know, but, you know, there is a lot of merit towards fundraising as well, like meeting the right investors who could speed up this process is always very helpful, especially if you have a lot of competitors, right? Like, and I think that's one thing in crypto, it's very early and a lot of the stuff that's being done is very innovative. So it's a good time for people to go into the space. But you still, ultimately, man, it has to be like the gamer thing we spoke about, right? Like it should be something that you want to use regardless of whether it's a Web 2 or a Web 3 platform. It's something that you like to use. And I think that's the key. Web 2 companies did that really well. Like, I really enjoy using a lot of these Web2 products. I really do because they're super personalized. The only part that annoys me is that it's personalized because they're taking my data from me. So I wish there was a bit more, you know, transparency into what's going on. I think everyone feels the same way right now.
Yeah, it's always just the evolution, right? You try to make it better than before.
Correct. So yeah, absolutely.
What would you say are the three key takeaways you want people to remember about Ethereum or your own personal journey that you think that actually, you know, helps them on their own journey?
So I guess Ethereum directly is for everyone to have that moment, light bulb moment, when they realize, why is it that I'm using a free app? And then I want them to understand that they're using a free app because they are the product. They are the ones who are providing this data. So the bottom line is your data is valuable. And if you think it's valuable now, just wait a few more years when AI is just going to be hungry for your data. It's going to be significantly more valuable. So the sooner you realize this, you start thinking about, okay, what maybe I could somehow take more control of my data. In fact, this is exactly what happened with, if you think about it, it's what happened with Bitcoin. Like 2008, everyone was happy to have their funds and stuff just in the centralized banking system. This is a huge issue. And then Bitcoin was born, and now we can take control of our financial assets. It's no different with Ethereum. Like it's an opportunity for you to take control of your data assets. So there will be this moment when we realize, okay, I need to take control. So hopefully people realize that this is something that's coming where the data is valuable. I guess the others, just relating to all the people like coming up with ideas, and I think we kind of just spoke about it, but you know, to persist, right? Like if you get an idea, build it. If you're not seeing any traction in a year, that's fine. Just keep persisting. Get stuff out, get users, try it out. If it's not getting attention, iterate, but just persist and just don't give up too early is probably the next takeaway in general for anybody trying to do products or product-based ideas. And yeah, I think it's an early, the last takeaway probably would be is that the whole blockchain and Web3 space is very early. It's still very, very early. So it's for young engineers or engineers who have, like me, who have been around for like two decades, there's still so much of opportunity. And that's, and the traditional Web2 market is very saturated. If you come up with an idea in the Web2 space, you'll have 200 different competitors ready to crush you in like a couple of weeks. But if you can come up with a solution to a Web2 problem using Web3 technology, you probably won't have much more competitors. So this is a very unique opportunity for people who are entrepreneurial, right? To like jump into this space, which is about to like take off, right? So I think that's like probably the last takeaway in general I have.
Well, I think the last thing missing is a huge thank you from my side, Mark, for taking the time being on the show. And yeah, hope you like it. Same for obviously all the viewers around here. And yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, Kevin. Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed the show. I love the questions. And yeah, this, hopefully we could do another one of these at some point.
Sure thing. So when doing my research, what I saw is that your protocol is actually based on Multiverse X. Is that correct? Like,
yeah.
I'm completely honest with you, I haven't heard of it yet, but I saw that it's right. Claiming to be the most decentralized network out there. Like,
right. Okay.
Tell me a little bit about it.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people haven't heard of it. They recently had a name change. They used to be called Elrond. I think a lot of people probably know it as Elrond. So they did a naming change. So as I was saying, we actually launched the protocol 2.5 years ago, close to 3 years ago. We actually began building in EVM. So we were building on Polygon and Ethereum. And then we took part in a bunch of hackathons, and then we won a few. And then in one of those hackathons, one of the co-sponsors was Elrond Network. And we had no idea about them as well. So we got introduced to them. And then I started exploring the technology. I read their white paper. And remember in 2020, it was only EVM, and there was like nothing else either, right? So, and there was Polygon and Ethereum, and that's pretty much it. There's no L2s as well at that point. So we were like, building a data protocol makes no sense on Ethereum. It's just so heavy on gas. This if you have a lot of trade of data, makes no sense. So then we started digging into Elrond, and they had multi-sharded architecture, adaptive state sharding, which means basically it's elastic, so you can scale up and down. And they had I remember what I really liked about it was I got their wallet, and it was the first wallet that I liked using. The user experience was amazing. And then I understood that, you know, the tech was good. The user experience is great. And this is kind of the same narrative we wanted for Ethereum, where the tech is good and the user experience is great. So you don't really care about the tech because the user experience is great.
So we started talking to them, and then I loved it that the VM was Wasm, and it was you write contracts in Rust, which is a lot better than writing it in Solidity and having all the security issues with it. So we committed to it. So we built our current protocol is built on Multiverse X, previously called Elrond, but you know we are multi-chain, so we are actually in the process of building components in different chains. So we are not going to replicate the protocol. We are going to componentize the protocol in different chains. We call it omni-chain design. I'm not sure if you've heard of this, but
yes, you will.
It's collectively the protocols on multiple chains, and you don't care about it if the accounts are abstracted, right? So yeah, that's our goal.
Cool stuff. Sounds pretty exciting. Like what's the last question from my side, if you don't mind?
Yeah, sure.
Like what's the benefit of having these components on multiple chains?
Yeah, the user liquidity.
Okay.
Purely. Mm-hmm. Think about it, right? Like we've launched on Multiverse X, and yeah, it's early stages, but we need more. Like, I think this is kind of common now with a lot of the Web3 protocols. You need eyes on the protocol. You need users. You need people to come and test it to use it. So we want to have omni-chain because, the user base is one, so we can tap into different user bases from different chains. But also, some chains do tech better than the other chain. Like Multiverse X has got a great sort of layer for our core protocol. But if you want to do like ZK stuff, we might as well go to a chain that's ZK first, right? Mm-hmm. So it makes sense to move that component over there. And thanks to a lot of these cross-chain messaging protocols, hopefully we get to a stage where we don't care about what chain we're building in, right? Like no one talks about, hey, I'm building on AWS. Like, they probably have AWS, GCP, Azure. No one cares. It's that the app is on top and it's abstracted everything away. So hopefully that's kind of where it ends up in.
Yeah, I think so anyway, right? Simply because Ethereum and so on actually just become a settlement layer. It just looks like it, right? And we move towards L2s, alt L1s, and these kind of things.
Yeah. I think ultimately, if maybe the point at which blockchain is mainstream is when no one mentions a name of a chain anymore. I think if you open up Twitter now, that it's just people just talking, debating chains. Like this we have to move from this, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. It's completely fucked up. Let's say it as this, right? It's the same with you are actually being paid of using infrastructure. With airdrops, grants, and all these things, which makes sense to some extent, right?
Early stages, man. Yeah. It was the same when clouds came up. I don't know if you remember, like when clouds first came up. I remember when AWS first came up. Our company used AWS, and everyone was like a AWS maxi in the company, right? Like if you talk about any other cloud, they get pissed off. Okay. It's the same thing, man. It's the same thing. So it'll be interesting to see where this ends up.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, cool stuff.
Cool. All right.
Wave awesome. Act, the Web3 software company that understands what you want.